Good evening. Welcome to the fifth installment of Let's Rock and Roll. I'm your host, DJ Treble, and I can't wait for my classic soul to share some classic rock knowledge with you all every Monday night on radio.dominican.edu, the official radio station of Dominican University of California. Each week, I will be telling you all about a legendary band from the classic rock era, we're talking 60s and 70s here, that will have the baby boomers feeling nostalgic, and the newer generations ready to discover something old, yet something brand new. This week, we'll be jamming together to a landmark band, Pink Floyd.
Money, it's a gas.
Now, Pink Floyd began as bassist Roger Waters' band, and this becomes increasingly more obvious as the years go by. We'll touch on that later. Definitely, we will be talking about that later. But the band was created in late 1963 by fellow architecture students Waters and drummer Nick Mason. They were part of a six-piece band called Sigma Six, which featured Waters on lead guitar, which is really crazy to think about now, Wright on rhythm guitar, also very crazy to think about, but there weren't enough keyboards around when they were rehearsing, so most of the time he just defaulted to rhythm guitar. And Mason on drums, the only constant in this band. Their first performances were at private functions while they rehearsed at their school, the London Polytechnic. In September of that year, Waters and Mason move in together at a flat in London, and throughout most of 1964, Sigma Six undergoes a plethora of name changes. Now listen to these names. The Megadeths, the Abdads, and the Screaming Abdabs, Leonard's Lodgers, which was a personal favorite of Waters, and the Spectrum Five before everyone could be satisfied with the T-Set, the most English-sounding one from the list. How stereotypical. The band's changing setup also forced Waters to switch to bass guitar. Now we're getting normal here. Something that he would stick with for the rest of time. Same with Richard Wright. He would finally adjust to the keyboards because they finally found keyboards. And the band is slowly becoming Pink Floyd, but we're not quite there yet. 1964 also saw the arrival of guitarist Syd Barrett. After two original Sigma Six members, Keith Noble and Clive Metcalf, quit to form their own band, which I never heard them release any music, so, I mean, who's the real winner here? Barrett arrived in London in 1962 from his hometown of Cambridge, England, to study art. Waters and Barrett actually grew up together, and they were childhood friends, as Waters would travel to Barrett's house and witness him playing guitar at his mother's house. The T-Set's first recording session began in December 1964, with Barrett on rhythm guitar, Waters on bass, Mason on drums, Bob Close on lead guitar, he was Waters' other flatmate in that flat in London in 1964, Nick Mason moved out, so he moved in, and was also part of the band. And initially, an old buddy of theirs, Chris Dennis, on vocals. He actually never got to actually record anything substantial because he was assigned duty at the Royal Air Force, England's military, so he had to leave, and that prompted Barrett to become their frontman and lead singer. Now, Richard Wright, although was part of the band, he wasn't present for the sessions, but he would still contribute his little pieces. But later in 1965, the T-Set becomes a regular band at the Countdown Club in London, playing three sets of 90 minutes each from late night into dawn. During these performances, the band realized they would lose their audience if their sets became too repetitive, playing the same songs over and over again. So, to fix this, they began to extend their songs with lengthy solos. Bunch of keyboard solos from Wright and kind of expanding the guitar sound from Barrett and even some screeching from Waters, something he really does well. It's kind of weird. However, Bob Close quits in mid-1965 after peer pressure from his parents and his peer pressure from his college studies. Now, I like to think it went something along like, "No, Bobby, you can't become a rock and roll star. I don't care if it'll make you famous. You're better off going to college." "But, Mom, I said no, and that's final." "Fine." I mean, that's exactly how it went. I was there. No, just kidding. But I'm pretty sure that's how that went. I like to think that. Well, anyway, this change leads to Barrett playing lead guitar, and the first incarnation of Pink Floyd is born. As frontman and new lead guitarist, Syd Barrett decides he wants to change the name to the Pink Floyd Sound in late 1965, after seeing another band perform at one of their gigs, also called the T-Set. I mean, what are the odds of that? So now this is the origin story of Pink Floyd's name, and I'm pretty sure you don't know this one. Even when I looked it up, I didn't even realize this. Pink Floyd actually came from Barrett's two favorite blues musicians, Pink Anderson and Floyd Council. He took the first names of both and just combined it together. I never would have thought a band like Pink Floyd, who I don't really hear much of a blues influence in their music, especially later, their name would come from blues musicians. I just think that's totally interesting. But by 1966, the group mostly played psychedelic renditions of rhythm and blues songs and were now receiving paid gigs, notably at the Marquee Club in March 1966, where their future manager, Peter Jenner, discovered the band. He was really impressed mostly with Syd Barrett, and his loyalties would stay with Barrett for a long time, as well as Richard Wright for their abilities to create trippy sounds on guitar and keyboard. So Jenner becomes their manager with the guidance of his business partner, Andrew King. And he's all like, yeah, we want to sign you to a record deal. We want you to release an album. You guys are good. You're going to make it. So on this edition of Marketing Strategies in Rock and Roll, something I talk about all the time, Jenner suggests that the band drop the sound part from their name because it just is so long. The Pink Floyd sound, that's too long. Just shorten it to Pink Floyd. So that's exactly what happens. Pink Floyd becomes the biggest band in the London underground music scene, a scene where bands pretty much play their music apart from the mainstream culture. Also known nowadays as hipster bands, those bands that you hear at coffee houses and really, really tiny clubs, but no one's ever heard of them. And they'll take whatever path of creative freedom they want before the big brother music commercializing record dealer people take it away and sell them out. That's actually not what happens, but, you know, hipsters tend to be angry about when their bands become famous. I knew them before they were cool, as if they have some sense of entitlement. Anyway, I'm digressing. But by now in 1966, Pink Floyd is performing concerts full of extended jam sessions of their songs and colored slides and flashing lights for visual effect. It was just a trippy show. Because it's the late 1960s, you gotta be as trippy as possible. It was as psychedelic as you could get. Later that year, the band gravitates towards performing more and more original Barrett compositions. Many of them would be comprised together to create their debut album, The Piper at the Gates of Dawn. Their excellence with improvisation and long compositions leads the band to sign a deal with EMI Records in 1967. The band's first single, Arno Lane, is released on March 10, 1967, and this single was hit or miss with radio stations due to its lyrics about kleptomaniac transvestite. I kid you not. It's a catchy song, though. The single peaked at number 20 in the UK. However, their next single, See Emily Play, becomes the first definitive Syd Barrett song, and it was very well received by UK audiences, peaking number 6. Around the time the single was released, the band started to notice the mental deterioration of Syd Barrett. And this is I talk about this way too much with rock stars, but this is just all too common, and it's really heartbreaking because the guys that go through this are typically some of the most talented musicians to ever exist, but their demons and their lack of resistance to trying drugs and mixed with that rock and roll fame, it gets to you, and it definitely got to Syd Barrett. After their third performance on BBC's Top of the Pops, bandmates noticed their frontman began to unravel. His behavior was significantly altered due to his frequent use of LSD. Meanwhile, Pink Floyd released their first album, The Piper at the Gates of Dawn, in August of 1967. Songs featured on the UK version of the album include the very trippy Astronomy Domine, Interstellar Overdrive, a classic 9-minute Floyd song from this era that best emulated their extended song jam sessions during their underground scene days, and the obscure Bike. The US version of the album is drastically different, doesn't feature Astronomy Domine nor Bike, but still has Interstellar Overdrive, as well as their hit single, See Emily Play. Floyd was still popular in their underground scene, specifically at the UFO Club in London, where they frequently performed, but fans also began to witness Barrett's mental illness firsthand, because he would just appear absolutely lifeless. He would have his guitar, and his arms would kind of just be dangling, and he just looked tired all the time. and he became increasingly erratic. One assistant of Peter Jenner, June Child, commented that Barrett seemed, well, gone and lifeless, and he would just stand there. He definitely looked like he was detached from the band. But a turning point for Syd Barrett is when the band had to cancel an appearance at the prestigious National Jazz and Blues Festival, citing nervous exhaustion on Barrett's account. Waters arranged a meeting for Barrett to see a psychiatrist, but Barrett refused it, and even when the psychiatrist even got to see him, he deemed his condition incurable. His condition grew steadily worse around the band's first U.S. tour, even embarrassing the band on Dick Clark and Pat Boone's shows. And on the Pat Boone show, the performances would already be pre-taped with the music, and all the band members had to do was kind of mime to it. Syd Barrett wouldn't even do that. He would just stand there, and it definitely looked awkward. So Floyd was sent back home to London, and they became the supporting act for Jimi Hendrix's tour of England, but they knew Barrett's depression had to be dealt with initially. So their solution? Enter David Gilmour. He joins the band in December 1967 as another guitarist to kind of help out with Barrett and provide even more rhythm into their music. Gilmour and Barrett were old friends in the early 1960s during their Cambridge days, playing a guitar and harmonica together during lunchtimes at Cambridge Tech. Gilmour was added initially as a cover to Barrett's Idiosyncrasies, leaving Barrett as the main songwriter, but no longer a performer. Turns out Barrett became horrifically difficult to work with, writing songs impossible for the rest of the band to learn. Even photographs of the band in 1968 show an isolated Barrett staring into the distance and just looking completely detached. He simply just wasn't there anymore. So Barrett left officially in March of 1968. And also their manager kind of ditches Pink Floyd because, as I mentioned just a few minutes ago, he had really big loyalties towards Syd Barrett and really believed in his creativity and his genius with his music. So he ends up helping managing and producing Syd Barrett's solo albums. And he kind of ditches the band. So we're not going to talk too much about the management. We're going to talk about the band. So what Pink Floyd then discovered was lacking after Syd Barrett's departure was the creativity, the needs to write songs and kind of bring that spark that Pink Floyd absolutely needed. So the songwriting responsibilities now were bestowed onto Roger Waters, which is evidence number two that Roger Waters is really the most dominant person in the band, because immediately the songwriting duties were fallen onto him. However, Richard Wright also takes over some of the songwriting responsibilities as well as the composition of the songs. So those two guys really become the main people to bring it together, pretty much. So they began to create material, and from then on, Pink Floyd began to perform more of the Waters and Wright compositions, therefore kind of putting an end to the Syd Barrett era. However, we're going to end the Syd Barrett era with his final song off from Pink Floyd, Jug Band Blues, off of the second album, A Saucer Full of Secrets. This is my personal Syd Barrett Pink Floyd song. It's my favorite. And there are three distinct meter changes, probably representative of Barrett's creativity and madness. It's described as the definitive confession of Barrett's schizophrenia and nervous breakdowns. It's a heartbreaking song, but definitely one of the best. Here's Jug Band Blues on radio.dominican.edu.
It's awfully considerate of you to think of me here, and I'm most obliged to you for making it clear that I'm not here. And I never knew the moon could be so big, and I never knew the moon could be so blue, and I'm grateful that you threw away my old shoes and brought me here instead dressed in red. Winter.
Welcome back. This is DJ Trouble, and you're listening to Let's Rock and Roll on Penguin Radio. Pink Floyd releases their second album, A Saucer Full of Secrets, in June 1968, and features the first Roger Waters song, such as Set the Controls for the Heart of the Sun and Let There Be More Light. The demos proved to be difficult, as EMI producer Norman Smith encouraged the band to self-produce their own music. This backfired, as Smith had little faith in the band's music and creative direction. Pink Floyd even invented their system of notation because Waters and Mason couldn't read music. That's pretty cool. The album was another testament to the psychedelic era. I personally am not a fan of this entire album, but I find it pretty forgettable except for a couple songs such as Jug Band Blues, as you just heard. After the release of the album, Pink Floyd performs their first ever free concert in Hyde Park, and then another U.S. tour in July 1968, playing with The Soft Machine and The Who. In 1969, Floyd releases their third album, More, an album I have never listened to before and will probably not listen to. It's their first movie soundtrack album, and I actually have no interest in listening to it, sorry. But their first double album, Uma Guma, is also released this same year. The first disc contains live performances of their normal set list up until that point, and the second disc contains solo compositions by each member of the band, two by Roger Waters, becoming their fourth studio album within the double album, as well as their first live album. Both of these albums are considered psychedelic and avant-garde. However, both have also grown to sound dated, and the band all criticize Uma Guma, calling it an absolute disaster. Here's a fun fact for you. The title for the album, Uma Guma, is allegedly derived from a Cambridge slang term for sex used by a Pink Floyd roadie. Other speculation, especially from the roadie, just says, oh, I just made it up. But it's a funny word, Uma Guma. Anyway, the album was once considered one of the greatest live albums of all time. At the time, anyway. But has definitely lost its appeal, especially with more of the technology progressing as well as just better live albums. But the live version of Careful With That Axe, Eugene is definitely worth listening to, and it's perfectly fitting for a climactic scene in a horror movie. Watch the video too, because you'll see that Roger Waters has a blunt on the end of his bass guitar, and he just looks so funny, but it's creepy and it's perfect, and I highly recommend watching that music video. But I mean, Uma Guma features a song written by Roger Waters, now bear with me on this one, called Several Species of Small Furry Animals Gathered Together in a Cave and Grooving with a Pict. I mean, that's a full-on essay. And I wish I were joking, but no. Ironically, the song with the longest song title is the shortest song on the album. It's only 5 minutes. Most songs on this album were 8 to 9 minutes, even 12 to 13 minutes long. In October 1970, the band released their fifth album, Atom Heart Mother. And I'll be honest here, this is the period Pink Floyd I never really listened to. Yes, I'm still a Pink Floyd fan. I'm not a fake fan. Trust me. I don't only listen to The Dark Side of the Moon and The Wall, okay? Guys, I am a Pink Floyd fan. But this is just a period where some of their songs are super weird, and their albums just don't sound good together. But this is the beginning of Pink Floyd solidifying themselves as a progressive rock band, those who use a lot of instrumentation similar to jazz and classical music, as well as different time structures, sometimes even changing them in the middle of the song. Same goes for tempo and key. Anything to make the music sound weird and out of the normal range of the four beat structure. But yet, it just sounds so cool. Atom Heart Mother just does not sound cool. But Pink Floyd are the godfathers of prog rock, and they were the first British bands to start delving into this genre. And Atom Heart Mother was a wonderful attempt at it, but the band also ended up hating it, Gilmore and Waters in particular. UK audiences loved it. The album went number one, but it didn't peak high at all in the US. There's good prog, and then there's bad prog. I don't have a concrete opinion on the album, but I haven't heard good things about it. However, their next album, Metal, released in 1971, is a true progressive rock album. It's their first true prog rock album, and a favorite of mine from the band. It includes great songs like One of These Days, a haunting instrumental, and Echoes, a nearly 24-minute song that prog rock fans like myself live for. Another song off of this album, Saint-Tropez, is an unlikely Pink Floyd song. Written solely by Roger Waters, it's about an idealized day in Saint-Tropez, located in the French Riviera. There's a misunderstood lyric in the second to last line, making a date for later by phone. Roger Waters slurs this line, so Italian audiences misheard this for making a date for Rita Pavone, a well-known Italian singer at the time. You're going to listen for that and the striking contrast of the heaviness you usually expect in Pink Floyd songs. You're going to be listening to Saint-Tropez on Let's Rock and Roll on radio.dominican.edu.
As I reach for a peach, slide a ride down behind the sofa in Saint-Tropez. Breaking a stick with a brick on the sand, lighting a wave in the wake of an old sedan. Sleeping alone in the drone of the darkness, scratched by the sand that fell from my love. Deep in my dreams and I still hear her calling. If you're alone, I'll come home, home. Backward and homebound, the pigeon, the dove. Gone with the wind and the rain on the airplane. Bone in a home with no silver spoon. I'm drinking champagne like a good tycoon. Sooner than wait for a break in the weather, I'll gather my far-flung thoughts together. Speeding away on the wind to a new day. If you're alone, I'll come home, home, home.
Welcome back to Let's Rock and Roll on Penguin Radio. I'm your host, DJ Treble. The release of Metal gave birth to the emergence of Pink Floyd without any influence from Syd Barrett, but rather David Gilmour and Roger Waters' band. But in 1973, Pink Floyd released a little album called Dark Side of the Moon. It's really not good at all. Seriously, don't waste your time on it. It is absolutely abysmal. I'm just kidding. I could psychoanalyze this album for 10 hours. Sadly, I do not have that time. I'm limited to now 35 minutes, but I'll try my best. Pink Floyd is widely known on this album for their thoughtful lyrics on conflict, greed, the wasting of time, and mental illness. Dark Side of the Moon is representative of life to death from start to finish. The album features a prism with the light on the left and the rainbow on the right in front of a black background, which becomes the most distinguishable logo for the band. Everything about this album is iconic, and every song ranges from good to flawless. I don't particularly care for Money, the song you heard in the intro, but it plays a crucial role in the album, and the 7/8 time signature and bass guitar riff is so catchy, so I appreciate it. Fun fact, and try this at home. If you play Dark Side of the Moon to the beginning of The Wizard of Oz, it becomes the perfect soundtrack, and it matches up. For instance, Dorothy begins to run away from the tornado on the lyric, "No one told you when to run off of time." And Dorothy bouncing on the tightrope on the line from Breathe, "Balance on the biggest wave." And she falls off after the succeeding line, "You race towards an early grave." There's a connection. It's real. It's the Illuminati. Try it. But if not, the album itself is worth listening to before you do. The first five tracks, Speak to Me, Breathe, On the Run, Time, and The Great Gig in the Sky, deal with the first stages of human life, from living your own life to anxiety that comes with it, from the quickness of passing time in life to the inevitability of death. And the last five tracks, Money, Us and Them, Any Color You Like, Brain Damage, and Eclipse, deal with the stages of death. From pointless consumerism that life is wasted on, to the depressed feeling of conflict, from the mental illness brought upon by fame, which will kill you, to the after concept of unity and humanity. We're all the same in the end. Despite the album's lyrical genius, I'm playing you the instrumental, Any Color You Like. It's my favorite song on the album. And much like the theme of not truly having any choices in life, you have absolutely no choice but to listen to this on Let's Rock and Roll with DJ Treble on radio.dominican.edu.
Did You Know, brought to you by Penguin.
Took a deep breath in the mirror.
Sorry about that. Welcome back. We're going to pause for station identification. That was just a little bit of a technical difficulty in there. I didn't intend to play Taylor Swift on this show. This is Penguin Radio on radio.dominican.edu, the official radio station of Dominican University of California. Currently, you are listening to Let's Rock and Roll, and I'm your host, DJ Trouble. I hope you're enjoying this hour all about Pink Floyd, because we're nearly not finished yet. Heading towards the year 1975, I have an odd bit of trivia for you. It's trivia night on Let's Rock and Roll. The members of Pink Floyd were huge fans of the comedy troupe Monty Python, so much that they helped fund the 1975 film featuring them, Monty Python and the Holy Grail. The more you know, you needed to know that. You definitely did. Back to the music. Pink Floyd always managed to pay tribute to Syd Barrett, the most prevalent being on their 1975 album, Wish You Were Here. Following up on the success of Dark Side of the Moon was a colossal task at hand, but the band was saved by a four-note guitar phrase, performed randomly by Gilmour, that reminded Waters of Barrett. This would evolve into Shine On You Crazy Diamond, the nine-part song paying tribute to Barrett, with parts 1 through 5 on the first part of the album, and then the album ends with the last four parts. Kind of like a full circle thing. Syd even visited the studio in 1975, looking absolutely unrecognizable. He gained weight, he lost his hair, and it actually made Roger Waters cry a little bit when seeing him, because he saw the deterioration on him and kind of the weariness he was feeling, and it just broke his heart. So this furthered Waters' sadness over the rise and fall of their old bandmate and friend. The album itself is another favorite of mine, maybe just as good as Dark Side of the Moon, but with a totally different concept. You know those follow-up albums. It's so hard to follow up with Dark Side of the Moon. So, they did a pretty good job, though. But more trivia. The song Have a Cigar is one of two songs to not feature a member of Pink Floyd on lead vocals. Claire Torres sings this wailing on Great Gig in the Sky, and legendary British singer Roy Harper sings the vocals on Have a Cigar. All the lyrics on this album were written by Roger Waters, citing the beginning of Waters' complete takeover of the band, as well as his ego-inflating and need for full control. 1977's Animals is another Waters concept, this time discussing the animal farm theory that the human condition is reduced to three classes of animals in society: the dominant and combative dogs, the ruthless pigs, like the corrupted pigs, that's probably a better description, and the following herd of the sheep, the common folk. It's also a response to the punk rock movement in the late 1970s, contributing to the decline of progressive rock, which enabled more meaning to music. The band didn't mind this because it reminded them of their old underground music days, and they weren't going to succumb to playing very simplistic punk rock anyway, just talking about anger. I mean, they're still going to talk about anger, but they're going to do it with melodies and such. The album, although fantastic on its critiques on society with songs Dogs, which is mostly composed by Gilmour. He's the only other band member to get credit for composing songs on the album. Wright is kind of being pushed out of the band by Waters. Sheep, which features a biblical reference to Psalm 23, and Pigs, broken up into three different songs. The rest of the band, particularly Richard Wright, weren't pleased with Waters' egocentric dominance. On their final show on their In the Flesh tour in 77 in Montreal, Waters becomes so irritated with a group of excited fans in the front row, he actually spat at them with, you know, saliva on their face from Roger Waters. I don't know whether to be insulted or honored, but anyway, the incident after he explained himself to producer Bob Ezrin about his sense of alienation from the fans, wanting to build a wall to separate himself from all the fame and the fans and everything. So the inspiration now turns into Waters' new album. I mean, another Pink Floyd album, The Wall. This would become the last album to feature Richard Wright, for a while anyway. His departure was due to the lack of contributions, as well as his suffering relationship with Waters. The Wall is, you guessed it, another concept album straight from the mind of Roger Waters. The album is a rock opera that tells the story of Pink, a figment of Waters himself and Syd Barrett, describing the loss of his father during World War II, a direct event from Waters' life, abuse from his school teachers, an overprotective mother, and his failed marriage, while feeling abandoned and isolated. The bricks in the wall are the traumatic events in Pink's life. He becomes a rock star and ruins his wall, or ruins his relationships due to infidelity, drug use, and violence. The wall is now built, and Pink is absolutely isolated. While behind the wall, Pink goes insane and imagines himself as a fascist dictator performing at concerts similar to neo-Nazi rallies. Yeah, he becomes overwhelmed and wishes everything would end. Driven by feelings of torment and guilt, Pink tears down his wall, completing the cycle that is life, and he kind of comes back to reality. The song I'm playing for you next deals with Pink's experience in school and the abuse he received. It's called The Happiest Days of Our Lives and Another Brick in the Wall, Part 2. The latter features a school choir to emphasize Pink's idea of kids rebelling against their teachers. I'm going to play that for you right now on Let's Rock and Roll with DJ Treble on radio.dominican.edu.
Yeah!
Welcome back to Let's Rock and Roll with DJ Trouble. This hour, we've been listening and talking about all about Pink Floyd, and it's an interesting one tonight. I really enjoy this show. I wish I really had more than an hour to talk about this band. I could go on forever. But we'll just have to make time with what we have. After a release at The Wall, a movie was adapted from the album in 1982 called Pink Floyd, The Wall. Bob Geldof, an actor, an Irish actor, and a friend of the band, plays the role of Pink. The movie doesn't contain much dialogue, as it's driven by the music on the album. And that's kind of where the dialogue comes from, directly from the songs. I've seen the movie plenty of times, and it's a really weird movie. It kind of trips your mind a little bit. All the madness, surrealism, violence, gore, sex, and animation your heart has ever desired is in this film. I do recommend seeing it at least once, because you'll never forget it when you watch this movie, whether you like it or not. That same year, Roger Waters releases his solo album, The Final Cut. Oh, just kidding, guys. It's just another Pink Floyd album. But let's be real, Waters has basically gone full-on dictator status with the Pink Floyd brand. At this point, the tension was at an all-time high, and this would be Waters' final album with the band. Originally planned as the soundtrack album to The Wall movie, The Final Cut became an anti-war and an anti-Margaret Thatcher concept album, rooting from the betrayal he felt after his father's death in World War II. One song in particular, The Fletcher Memorial Home, centers around the idea of gathering political leaders including Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, Joseph McCarthy, and Richard Nixon, to name a few that are listed on the song, and giving them the final solution, which was Hitler's plan to eliminate the Jewish population through genocide in Nazi Europe, aka the Holocaust. I'm going to be playing that for you tonight. Not this song, though, but Waters' father, Eric Fletcher Waters, and his death during the Battle of Anzio in World War II, and this tribute to him. It's called When the Tigers Broke Free, and you're listening to this on Let's Rock and Roll with DJ Trouble on radio.dominican.edu.
Just before dawn, one miserable morning in Black 44, when the forward commander was told to sit tight, when he asked that his men be withdrawn, and the generals gave thanks as the other ranks held back the enemy tanks for a while, and the Anzio bridgehead was held for the price of a few hundred ordinary lives. And kind old King George sent Mother a note when he heard that the father was gone. It was, I recall, of a scroll with gold leaf and all, and I found it one day in a drawer of old photographs hidden away, and my eyes still grow damp to remember his His Majesty signed with his own rubber stamp.
It was dark all around, there was frost in the ground, when the tigers broke free. And no one survived from the Royal Fusiliers Company C. They were all left behind, most of them dead, the rest of them dying. And that's how
welcome back to Let's Rock and Roll on Penguin Radio. I'm your host, DJ Treble. The departure of Waters is a messy story in itself. After the release of his first solo album, The Pros and Cons of Hitchhiking, yes, his actual first solo album, not the three that he pretty much created with Pink Floyd, he made it adamant that Pink Floyd was dead without him, and they would never reunite. He said this in 1985, and they would reunite 20 years later, but not talking about that right now. We're talking about right now, the really bad part. It ended with Waters going to court to attempt to dissolve the band and prevent anyone else from using the Pink Floyd name, because he really thought he was the main guy, and he, like, without him, Pink Floyd would have died a long time ago, and just ego, ego, ego. David Gilmour was the most angry at Waters, more than ever, released a statement against him, saying that Pink Floyd will carry on without him, because he is just so adamant about, no, this isn't your band, this is our band. And this pisses off Waters, who would become an even bigger egotistical jerk or critic of whatever Pink Floyd decided to do. Now, of course, I do like Roger Waters. I respect him as a musician, but he was just a jerk in this. But Gilmour decides to release the 1987 album, A Momentary Lapse of Reason. He welcomes back Richard Wright into the band and recruits a bunch of musicians to create the album. A Momentary Lapse of Reason, personally, it sucks. It's evident that Floyd was suffering without Waters' creativity. Even Waters heavily criticized the album, particularly throwing shade at Gilmour more than anything, calling his lyrics third rate. Although Gilmour was pretty angry about it, Richard Wright was like, nah, dude, he's right. I mean, come on, we're kind of lagging on without him. But Waters went even as far as threatening to sue promoters in the US if they used the Pink Floyd name during the band's tour for the album. This backfired, as Floyd played at bigger venues than Waters did solo. Like, he would, like, take in San Francisco, for example. Like, Pink Floyd would perform at, well, I know it's crashed down now, but say they would perform at Candlestick Park, or now AT&T Park, and Waters would perform at, like, a very tiny venue, like, probably like the Fillmore, pretty much. Like, not too bad, but not as big as, say, a ballpark. And they would be in the same city. He played the smaller venues. It's kind of funny. It's almost karma to an extent. But more legal troubles occur with the band name, and Pink Floyd reaches a settlement at the end of 1987, giving Nick Mason and Gilmour the full rights to the name, and Waters the right to, notably, The Wall. 7 years later, Pink Floyd releases The Division Bell, dealing with themes of communication, something they obviously lacked when, you know, Waters was in the band. The best song on the album, High Hopes, is an autobiography of Gilmour's life, recalling his early days with Pink Floyd, leaving his hometown and following his dreams. It's the final track on the final album, For a While. This is kind of like a farewell to Pink Floyd, for now. But here's High Hopes, only on Penguin Radio.
Along the long road and on down the causeway. ragged band followed in our footsteps. Running before time took our dreams away. Leaving the myriad small creatures trying to tie us to the ground, to a life consumed by slow decay. The grass was greener, the light was brighter. With friends around us, the nights of wonder. Looking beyond the embers of bridges glowing behind us, a glimpse of how green it was on the other side. Steps taken forwards, but sleepwalking back again. Dragged by the force of some inner tide.
Welcome back to Let's Rock and Roll on Penguin Radio. This is your host, DJ Treble. We're wrapping things up here on the fifth installment of the show tonight, paying an hour-long tribute to the timeless Pink Floyd. Now, I just give mad props to David Gilmour for carrying on Pink Floyd without Roger Waters, because Gilmour is just as great as a musician as any of the others in the band, and he definitely deserves his credit, especially in The Division Bell, which is the better album. But after the release of The Division Bell, nothing happened in regards to Pink Floyd until their induction to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1996. The band reunited Gilmour, Waters, Wright, and Mason in 2005 for the Live 8 concert in London's Hyde Park, also where their first free concert was performed 40 years back. This reunion was a patch-up for all the animosity caused 25 years back by Roger Waters, pretty much. After their performance, Waters brings the rest of the band in for a group hug at the end, and it was just so cute, and it was kind of just, you know, that's their last performance ever with the four of them, and that would be it for Pink Floyd, nothing else, and there will never be any other performances. So it was nice how it went out that way. Anyway, Syd Barrett died in 2006, and the band members each paid tribute by performing his songs. Richard Wright also died in 2008. As his initial tribute regarded him as the quiet member of Floyd, similar to George Harrison. Now, George Harrison always sneaks into my radio show somehow. Gotta get him in somewhere. As a tribute to Wright, Gilmour and Mason decide to reincarnate their recordings created with their late bandmate, which would become the final Pink Floyd album, The Endless River, released in 2014. Pink Floyd will forever go down as rock and roll martyrs for their contributions to the birth of progressive rock movement, as well as their lyrical themes on critiques of society, politics, and human nature. Their musicality is unprecedented, with Gilmour as one of the greatest guitarists of all time. They're truly one of the best bands ever, and I'm so lucky that I got to discover them. And, well, that's all for the history of Pink Floyd, but tonight I do have a heavy heart this week in terms of this band, and this is why they're very special to me. This show tonight is dedicated to my late father, Stephen Furry, the biggest Pink Floyd fan I have ever met. He saw this band live on his birthday on April 20th, 1989, during the Momentary Lapse of Reason tour. Funny story, he volunteered to work at the concert along with his brother and a friend of his. Because back then, I think it happens still now, but you could have people like volunteer or get paid to kind of work the concert for the night because, yeah. The brother and the friend worked in the parking lot, kind of catering traffic and all that. And they missed the whole concert. They could hear it, but they didn't see it. My dad, however, worked crowd control at the very front, right below David Gilmour. His dreams had come true, and he cited that as the best concert he ever attended. And remember, he attended Woodstock. But if it wasn't for my father, this show would not exist. I wouldn't have the absolute passion for classic rock that I have, and I wouldn't be raised on good music, to be honest. But he was the man who exposed me to Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, all these amazing bands, and I thank him every day for this. And although he died around this time in 2006, it feels like he's never left. It's going to be 9 years, and I still can't, and it never gets easier with coping with the loss, but this is how I do it. This is how I think of my father in the best light possible, is through the music that he exposed me to. And I always pay tribute to him with Pink Floyd. And tonight is just only fitting, and I'm trying not to cry, but this is for you, Dad. I love you so much, and shine on your crazy diamond. On that somber note, that concludes tonight's show. Don't forget to check out all the other DJs at radio.dominican.edu. For my shout-out tonight, check out The Hookup and everything else about relationships with DJ Cabaret on Tuesdays from 1 to 2 p.m. I hope you enjoyed this hour about Pink Floyd tonight. This is DJ Treble, signing off with the great gig in the sky. This is Penguin Radio at radio.dominican.edu. Go Penguins!
Should I be frightened of dying? There's no reason for it. You've got to go somewhere.